Welcome to the How Leaders Think podcast, a show that helps you change the way you think so you can change the way you live and lead. I'm Kenny Lang, and with me today is John Grubbs. Based on his new book, The Wolf Sales Model, Non-Relationship Selling, John has created a powerful training series to help sales professionals learn the skills to hunt for new business. His hard-hitting method for results is not for every organization, only for those who are truly determined to improve and make difficult choices to win the game of business. Welcome to the show, John.
Thanks, Kenny Lang. Every time I say your name, I think of the Rocky movie, Clubber Lang. You know, do you remember that episode? Mr. T was playing Clubber Lang, and that was Rocky's.
Well, now medicine. I'm very interested, and I think I'll invest in a new hairdo and some chains.
There you go.
So I might even pity a fool. So, John, tell me, what has been on your mind lately?
Kenny, multipliers have been on my mind. I recently reread Liz Wiseman's book, Multipliers, and it has kind of hit me differently this time. You know, I'll give you an example. In the last 5 years, I have worked with many sales teams, and I've seen so many sales reps, high-end, highly capable sales reps, be promoted to sales manager, and they failed. So I'm thinking of an article right now called Kill the Term Manager. Why don't we change manager to multiplier? That's what I've been thinking about.
Interesting. So, and we'll grab links to the book and to that article for the show notes. But so in reading that, and obviously you've been in business a while, so you've seen, you know, multiple different approaches, but what are you seeing then as the current thinking or prevailing wisdom of being just a manager versus being a multiplier?
So if you think about the term multiplier and what it means to multiply, I think most people see human resources as additive. In other words, we need to add resources. And what I think Liz did a great job of in her book, she says, you know, if you look at a multiplier versus someone who's a diminisher, maybe just a general manager or even a bad manager, she says you can multiply human capital rather than just add human capital. And that really resonated with me.
I like that. So when we're thinking about that and we're thinking about managers and somebody's out there listening, maybe they are a manager, maybe they aspire to be and keep moving up the ranks of a corporation. What would you tell them about why that sort of thinking of traditional management is unproductive? Because this sounds like a different way of thinking that flies in the face of what has been the conventional wisdom.
Yeah, we've been practicing the same carrot and stick management for over 100 years now. And I think most people realize that there's a change afoot in the workplace. There's a change in how we lead the workplace. 10 years ago, there was a Harvard Business study that said 75% of people quit a job because of their relationship with their direct supervisor for having a bad boss. Well, I recently did a poll, and what I found out is that almost half of people that are in what they consider a toxic workplace, the reason it's toxic is not the boss. It's a lack of accountability for the coworkers who aren't carrying the load. And I think we've seen a shift in the last 10 years from the boss being the issue to coworkers who are not being held accountable as the issue that is causing this disengagement at work.
Gotcha. That makes me think of something Dave Ramsey in his Entree Leadership book talks about. It's not the five dysfunctions of the team, because that's Lencioni, but he talks about that there are five ways that you're killing team unity or something to that effect. And one of them was sanctioned incompetence. And that could sound harsh, but it's an accurate descriptor, I think, of what you were just describing, which is basically people who they aren't giving 100% in their job. They're not fulfilling the duties, responsibilities, and hitting the KPIs and metrics that they're supposed to. And when you look around and feel like you're the only one giving the effort for that, it's demoralizing because in your mind, even if you're a grown adult, you still expect, if you have someone who's in authority over your team, to go to that person and say, hey, you're not performing the way that you should, and we've expected. Would you say that that's accurate? The sanctioned incompetence is an accurate term for what you described?
Well, I'll give you an example. I'm working with two global chemical companies right now, and the issue with engagement, I did an analysis with both companies, and the issue with engagement has continued to surface. And here's the prevailing thought. If you can get hired past your initial period of
onboarding,
probationary period, if you can pass your probationary period, as long as you show up to work and don't do anything egregious, you have a job for life. And what that has done is it's created this almost this attitude that I don't have to do a lot of work, and I'm okay. I'm not going to be held accountable for doing anything more than the bare minimum. And it's that bare minimum that I think is causing angst for the high performers who are going to pick up extra load. They're going to do the work. They're not going to leave things undone. Yeah. And it's causing wholesale disengagement in many workplaces right now.
I see. So yeah, I definitely could see why. So if you're sitting across the table from a leader and they're bringing up these things and you're saying, hey, it sounds like maybe there's some things in their leadership that are allowing that to happen. Because sometimes it can be hard, especially for newer managers, newer leaders, right? They want to be friendly. They want to make sure that they're well liked. I mean, who amongst us is just says, I just love being hated, and it is fantastic, right? Like, nobody's saying that except for psychopaths. But how would you tell them to start thinking like a multiplier kind of manager and leader, and shift the way that they are even considering leadership from now until, you know, eternity?
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, early in my career, I was able to assume a leadership position at 24 years old. Someone thought because I had a college degree, I would make a great supervisor, and I failed miserably. That failure didn't prevent me from getting promoted to manager at age 27. And I made all sorts of mistakes as a manager. But here, this was what I learned. I said, you know, I was a pleaser. I was someone who wanted people to like me. Mm-hmm. And it took me several iterations of failure to understand that it's not being liked that's essential as a leader. It's being respected. And mm-hmm. I had to subordinate that urge to be liked in order to maintain respect. And respect meant doing the hard things, providing accountability for the team, you know, enforcing whatever, you know, I was asked to do as the manager on behalf of the organization. Right. That was a huge learning curve for me in my early 30s. And that's what I would tell a manager. If you want to be successful in that role, you're going to have to give up that innate need to be liked and opt for doing things that are going to gain the respect and eventual trust, because respect is mm-hmm. often a predicate of trust, you know, of the people that you're blessed enough to lead or serve.
Right. I think that's great. And I, some similarities there to your story, because I could sell. I got quickly promoted to manager and we're leading people 10, 15. I even had a guy who's 50 years older than me. And, I repeated what I saw my manager do, but it wasn't my style because everybody seemed to like him. And I was like, all right, well, I'll try that and I'll try to make favorable decisions. And, I made all sorts of mistakes. So I've got some good scars. Now, how has that thinking overlapped, you know, in the introduction talks about the, you know, your new book, The Wolf Sales Model and non-relationship selling, which probably takes some people by surprise. I love the shock value. You definitely piqued my interest when I saw that on LinkedIn. I was like, wait, what? Yeah. But how do you see that? How would you weave that advice for respect and being a multiplier? How is that affecting sales, especially in our current environment where it seems like the role of salesperson keeps evolving? Right. And it's not just, well, I have more automation, but there's actual fundamental changes happening in what great salespeople look like and what's being asked of them. And not everybody's making the shift. How would you weave those two together?
Well, the thesis is, this is the misconception in the world of sales. A client will become a friend faster than a friend will become a client. And the misconception out there is that if I'm friendly to people, if I can become their friend first, that they'll buy from me. And that's the big fabrication in my mind. You know, we want to buy value. And if you're only around me and I sense it, and we have a great sixth sense for people's intentions. If you're only being friendly with me because you want me to buy something from you, it creates a disingenuous relationship from the beginning. And what I teach sales reps is, hey, let's go out there and earn the sale first. Let's earn it through value, through a true dedicated value proposition. And then if we want to build a relationship after that, that's okay. If it happens organically after that, it's okay. It's the relationship after the sale, not the false relationship before the sale.
Gotcha. So you would say that most sales reps are essentially putting a cart before the horse. They got things out of order.
Yeah.
That's the part, kind of like you were talking about with managers, of being liked as opposed to being respected. You can be liked as well, but you can't sacrifice the respect. Would you say that those are somewhat paralleled?
Yeah. I mean, so I've been doing sales training for a long time. In recent years, 90% of the people that go through my classes are not prepared to sell or hunt. They're non-selling entities. They're non-selling professionals, but they've been given this title, maybe because they've had that title in the past. You know, it's really hard to vet a salesperson.
Yeah.
Well, I was in sales for 20 years. Okay. What did you do? What did you learn to hunt? Did you develop a new area? I mean, how did sales look? Well, if you're not a salesperson, if you're an HR person or a general manager, it's really hard to vet a salesperson. And we really look at their resume and trust that what they say on their resume is true. And we know how often that is accurate.
Right. I heard someone say once that, like on a resume, you may see, well, to your point about, oh, I've got 20 years experience. And this stuck with me, is that they said, well, 20 years is not the same for everybody. Some people have 1 year experience 20 times. Hmm. Other people have 20 years of experience. They've continued, they've evolved. And that's, you know, so not all things are equal, right? Not all time spent is equal. So if someone's thinking about generating respect and being honest, because that could feel at times, I mean, I do business development. I sell, you know, as do you, to you know, put money in the bank and food on the table. How do you go about it without it being, you know, like one of these LinkedIn people? You get hit with a solicitation the second you accept their invite, and they're not trying to be my friend, clearly, because they're doing that and it irritates the bejesus out of me. But they're also not earning my respect. So that feels like those people have fallen in a different ditch. Like, how do you bring that back to where you will respect what I have to say and offer in it, and the value seems clear?
So I'll tell you where this concept for the Wolf sales model and non-relationship selling came from. I had worked with several large sales teams nationally. They were coming into my studio. We were doing training. And one of the modules that I teach is how to do proper discovery with a potential new client. And I would tell them, okay, here's a methodology. I want you to go into groups or rooms if we're remote, and I want you to practice using this methodology of just asking questions and using labels to gain a deeper understanding of what the potential client needs. And I said, do it for 15 minutes and see if you can stay in discovery mode for 15 minutes. And as I would go and visit the groups or check in the rooms, within 5 or 10 minutes, they were doing something else. They couldn't sustain a deeper level of discovery for more than 10 or 15 minutes without slipping into the pitch. They wanted to, you know, talk about their product or talk about their service. They couldn't stay in discovery mode. And I started looking for that as patterns. And what I've discovered is so many sales professionals lack the skills to be true hunters in sales. It's not that they're not smart, super capable people. They've just learned the wrong way to sell, or they haven't developed the skills to stay in discovery mode long enough to unearth what are the emotions behind the buyer needs. You know, is someone wanting to buy this machine because they're frustrated because the last vendor wouldn't provide enough support and the machine was down all the time? So that the emotion is frustration. If I know that early in this discovery process, mm-hmm. don't you think I can use that as leverage later on in the buying journey?
Sure.
It's a lack of skills. That's what I've noticed.
So it's kind of like an undeveloped muscle. It's very weak. They can't lift much. They can't stay in that focus. Or it could be like a kid that doesn't have an attention span more than a goldfish. I'm speaking to my own children at this point. But something interesting there. Why do you think it's so difficult for people to stay in that position or that posture, that place of asking questions, staying curious, and why is that so difficult or uncomfortable?
I think you're right. It is a muscle and it has to be practiced and it has to be worked. You know, I think most sales reps are taught how to pitch their product or services and they feel compelled to make the pitch that I have to make the pitch. I have to make it in this first, if I don't impress them with my service or my product in this first meeting, they're never going to buy from me. It's that lack of patience to truly discern what problems the potential buyer is trying to solve. Mm-hmm. And if you can ever get to the core problem, the core emotion, the core issue, now you can start to build your product in a way that is that feels like it's specifically for them.
Mm. Okay. So what's a good way if they're uncomfortable, maybe staying curious, asking questions, what's a great way someone could start to strengthen that, right? You don't need them to jump down and bench press 225 right away, but everybody's got to start somewhere. What advice would you give to someone who's listening? Because I could see that applying equally in management to be a multiplier. Mm-hmm. Stay curious, ask questions, yeah. Wouldn't you? So where can someone get started and start building their muscles there?
So if I were telling a new sales rep or even an experienced sales rep who's struggling, that's listening to this podcast right now, if I were telling them how to do this or how to get started with this, it would be to write down, you know, 5 to 8 truly open-ended what or how questions. Mm-hmm. Have those open-ended questions written down before your first meeting with your client. And as they answer the questions, I want you to use 3 labels. And these are called, the questions are called calibrated questions, what or how questions. And then the 3 labels are, it seems like, it sounds like, it looks like. So if I ask you a question, if I say, hey, what's the biggest challenge you've had in getting a podcast started? How would you answer that question?
If you're asking me legitimately, it has been getting someone to do all the post-production editing so that they can be released. I'm great at the conversation and booking stuff, but getting them finished up has been a struggle.
It seems like it's a bit complicated.
A little bit. At least my schedule is complicated.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it's not just it's more than just the how to, it's the when to that you're struggling with.
Yeah, that's right.
So if you notice, I asked the what question and then I followed it up with 2 labels. And what I teach these sales reps to do is to be able to go back and forth, digging deeper into what's going on. And if you don't know that I'm doing it, you're going to give me a lot of information. Right, and by the way, I tell the sales reps, always ask permission to take notes. And, you know, even show your pen while you're taking notes, touch your chin, take notes.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the first discovery session, if I'm giving advice still, I'd say, now, ask permission to go back over your notes. Kenny, let me go back over my notes because I want to make sure I really understand what you're struggling with right now. And I go back through the notes. Mm-hmm. And I said, correct me if I've got anything wrong. And if they seem aloof or disengaged, I may even throw a false label out there sometimes just to get them to reengage. So a false label might be like, Kenny, it seems like podcasting may not be a big priority for you.
Gotcha. And then I can say, no, it is. I'm just struggling. So you got me to say no, which, you know, there's some great books on leading from that place, but at least no is better than yes, right? In certain cases.
And that's just one example. It blew my mind how many sales professionals couldn't do what we just talked about, what we just gave your listeners in a broader sense.
Interesting. That's really cool. Now, because much like other podcast interviewers, I'm going to be selfish and get some free advice. So I just told you, you know, I got back from a conference and I had people coming by the booth and saying, "What do you do?" Now, we did have one guy next to us that another coach heard and said, "How do you separate people from their money?" Which I thought was just kind of a funny way to ask, "What do you do?" If you're in that sort of situation, right, or a networking event and people jump straight to "What do you do?" I have found, at least for me, it activates that pitch yes. them now reflex. What advice would you give in that situation? Because it's one thing to schedule the sales meeting, the discovery meeting, you know, exploratory, whatever you call it, and go in, you have your questions, you have your preparation. It's another thing when people are actively asking, "Well, what do you do and how do you help?" right away, and to avoid that pitching sort of knee-jerk response.
Such a great question. So one of the things that I do real early in the training with the sales reps that I work with is teach them how to write a power statement. And a power statement is a one-page document. It's got four sections, a little bit about you, a little bit about the pain points that you help your customers solve, a little bit about how your organization does what it does. And then the bulk of the power statement is about how you're different from everyone else that you compete with. It's the differentiation part. And, you know, if you were asking me, if you came to my booth and I'm there with my Wolf sales model, and you said, "What do you do?" I might say something like, "Well, I teach how to sell without relying on relationships."
Just full stop.
Yeah. I want them to ask me a question is what I want.
Gotcha.
What does that mean? What does that mean? You know, and I might follow it up with, "Well, what kind of sales are you in? What sector are you in?" And they say, "Well, we're in the financial services sector." I say, "Oh, wow. I bet it's difficult to find really good financial advisors in this, you know, in this economy."
Right.
"Tell me what's going on."
Gotcha. So you have something to present them just to answer their question, because you don't want to be too cute or clever about it, but you give them something. And then quickly turn into, you know, asking them a question, then walk down the, you know, the accusation audits, the labels, the calibrated questions that you were just mentioning.
And sometimes you can be very direct. I call this avoiding the red herring in my training. The red herring is when they jump to "What do you do?" or "How much is this going to cost?" or all this, you know, that's the red herring. You know, I may give a really brief answer. Like if you say, "Hey, well, what's this going to cost me?" I say, "Hey, well, you know, I don't know, really know enough to give you a price right now. Let me ask you a few more questions so that I can give you a really good price on this. I want to give you the best price on this."
Right.
And then I go back into discovery mode.
Gotcha. So you didn't ignore what they said, but you just took it and redirected it back into the line of questioning. I gotcha. Yeah. So if, so people can, your, their first step, go make a list of those, you know, you said eight questions before their next meeting. And I would say even managers, you should be preparing for your meeting. If you want to be that multiplier, I want to go check out that book, from, you said Liz Weissman.
I actually talked to her on Monday. I had a question with her about comparing her work with multipliers to, Bradford Smart's work on top grading. I says, if you multiply an A player, do you get a different multiple than if you multiply a B player or a C player? And she said, we haven't compared those two bodies of work yet, but that's a great way of thinking about it, because I do think you get a higher multiple with A players.
I would assume so, but that sounds fascinating. I'm definitely going to hit you up, see if she gets back to you on that, because I'll be curious. But so salespeople, managers, if you want to, you know, multiply your leads, your sales, your pipeline, or just multiply your people, right? Because you're charged with not just making sure things get done, but that people are growing and that your area of influence is growing. So write down those questions before your next meeting. And I think just that simple level of preparation will build that muscle. John, if people want to know more about you, Wolf Sales Model Training, and what you're doing, where would you direct them?
So the easiest way to find me right now is johngrubbs.com. That's johngrubbs.com. And you can also Google Wolf Sales Model or Wolf Sales Training. Any of that will put you back towards me and my body of work. I think what I want listeners to get from this podcast is that if you do want to be more effective in training or in selling or in managing, whatever you do, you know, the first thing we have to do is work on our mindset. You know, you talked about multipliers and managers. A great experiment for your listeners to do is in their next meeting, try not to make any statements. Try to stay in question mode only.
Okay.
And see how long they can do that. That'll test their ability to do discovery in a non-selling environment. And Liz Weissman actually did it with her kids one night. And she said the whole night changed from getting them to bed to, you know, the stress level came down. I mean, it's just stay in question mode. Don't get in statement mode or declarative or don't order people around. Just ask questions and you'll see a change in the people's response. So mindset, skills, and habits. That's the three tenets of the Wolf Sales Model. What's the mindset of a hunter? What are the skills of a hunter? And what are the daily habits of a hunter to be successful in sales?
I love that. Thank you so much, John, for coming on and sharing your wisdom. And I hope to have you back in the future when you've got some more research.
Awesome. Thank you.